Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
With the Monsanto case, the entire case was brought ostensibly to protect innovation in the United States. But the seed industry is a highly concentrated industry where that's controlled by just a few companies. And even in the course of my reporting, Monsanto was acquired by Bayer. So by the end of the case, it was no longer even an American company. So you have this irony of the US government expending massive resources trying to protect the IP of an American company, and the company just leaves its borders.
This week, we are very excited to bring you Mara Vistendahl. She is author of Scientist and the Spy, A True Story of China, the FBI, and Industrial Espionage. So true Realignment fans will know that this book was actually on my list for the best books that I read in 2020. Mara's book just came out in paperback. We wanted to have her on the show to explain this just incredible story of industrial espionage. It starts, literally the book starts, with a person, a Chinese man, who was stopped by a cop in the middle of Iowa, in the middle of all of these cornfields. And he's like, what the hell are you doing here? From there, it spirals into one of the most fascinating industrial espionage cases involving the FBI, geopolitics, and it's something that I think encapsulates a lot of what we talk here about the realignment, our changing relationship with China, how the U.S. government should respond with big business, how big business itself has been complicit. There's so much here for everybody. And Mara is a really great guest.
What I love about this is, and I say this during the episode, there's something for pretty much every listener in this show. If you're on the right, there is talk of espionage, there's geopolitical concerns. If you're on the left, there's a really legitimate conversation about the role that the FBI and the US government can play in perpetuating racism and just engaging in pretty blatant discrimination going back to the 1950s and 1960s. The key takeaway then too is that what we are always trying to do on the show is help you all know what to think, know how to approach things. And look, Mara disagrees with us on quite a few many things. I didn't want to just do another episode on China, which was the China Hawk Hour part 12. So this is nuanced. You're going to get a different bit of perspective here. And this is an excellent book if you are just trying to get a good summation of where this relationship stands at the start of the Biden administration.
That's exactly right. Okay. And you guys know the drill. Make sure you guys hit subscribe to therealignment.substack.com. It's our weekly newsletter where you get transcripts, you get more inside stuff, and now you get to ask questions. You can reply to the email. You can take a comment there. We've been getting some great questions there in the comment section. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and check out that bookshop.org link, which is in our Substack page. That is where you can help support the show and you can help an independent bookstore during COVID-19 and try and buy Mara's book in particular. So let's get to the question and answer period.
So reminder, there are a couple of different ways you can get questions of us. Leave them in a 5-star review. Email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com or reply directly to our Substack. We love to take questions there. Today's question is from Keenan. Hi, Marshall and Sagar. I'm 19 and a big fan of the show. I might characterize myself as progressive on the political spectrum, but I've been seriously reconsidering where I stand. We all know. Quick editorial note, we all know where this is going a few episodes down the line. He'll be asking us about third parties and Tulsi Gabbard. Right. So, Keenan, if you're out there, just we know where this is going. Send the question
you,
in a few weeks.
I see you.
I just finished reading The Scientist and the Spy and really liked it. Great recommendation. One thing I took away from the book was that China and the US are very much interdependent in multiple ways. With that being said, what should the administration's next approach to China be? From what I've seen, being too tough came back to bite us, trade war effects on the farmer, but being too soft let them walk all over us. Let me know what you guys think and keep up the amazing work. What do you think, Sagar?
Keenan, you just got to a very key and important part of the discussion, which is that the balance is absolutely the key. And I would actually reject the idea that the trade war did more damage than it did good in terms of reframing our relationship, I think, for the next 20 to 50 years. But more importantly, it's how exactly do we approach regulation itself? Marshall and I actually talked a little bit about this in the episode. And actually, I was talking with my friend Joe Wiesenthal, and there's a theory of regulation in finance, which I actually think applies to this. And I can't get the exact name. I think it's called like the Herman Minsky theory of finance, which is that instead of having regulations set in stone about what is allowed and what's not allowed, it's actually more important to empower regulators to react to real-time conditions. And so when I think about China, I mean, if we were thinking about China technology transfer in like 2003, back when George W. Bush's brother, this is not a true story, while he was president of the United States, was lobbying for a Chinese semiconductor company, at the time, I don't think anybody really knew semiconductors were going to be so important. But now we do. So it would be wrong not to pass it then, and then are we too late to pass it now? I just thinking of these things dynamically, and with like the tech and the clubhouse question that we get to in the episode, is the way that we should go about this. What do you think, Marshall?
Yeah, two things. One, you all know that Sagar and I are not policy experts, so it's pretty clear to us as generalists who like these different issues that no one has quite come up with that perfectly articulated balance between not being too soft, but not just being unthinking and acting as if you're a bull in a China shop. That being said, our perspective is the mentality is key here. Because the key issue consistently has been administrations have assumed, hey, we let China in, everything goes hunky-dory. If you're in the Obama administration, you think, hey, this mostly largely works, let's just get that done. So the key attitude that we expect and hope to continue to see from the Biden administration is a recognition that separate from specific policy initiatives, what matters most is recognizing that there's no going back to the time before Donald Trump became president, and that on a broad narrative level, the truly important thing his presidency did, separate from debates with individual policies, was just acknowledge the fact that the accommodationist approach for China has basically not worked for the past 20 years. So it's really the mentality and approach that you should all be looking for. After we all agree on that, then the policy debates themselves will become more significant and will be more important.
That's a great point. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Really appreciate their support. Let's get to it.
Mara Vissendahl, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Good to see you, Mara.
Good to see you.
So last year, your book, The Scientist and the Spy, A True Story of China, the FBI, and Industrial Espionage, was actually one of our favorite reads. I got it on Audible literally right before our lockdowns happened. So the two of us actually like went through and listened and really enjoyed it. And the part that I want to make clear here to everyone is also one more thing to make clear. It's in our bookshop. Definitely go check it out. A bunch of you have already purchased the book. Got some great questions. We were actually going to ask Mara directly from that there. But what I enjoyed so much about the book is that there was pretty much something for everyone when it came to the ideological spectrum. So if you're on the right, China, industrial espionage, there's that conversation which you could fit into your narratives. But if you're coming more from a center or left perspective, you do have a very frank conversation about discrimination and a lot of like really, frankly, horrible behavior is an understatement going back to the 50s and 60s during the excesses of the Cold War. So this is clearly a story from my perspective that is going to just not just leave everyone satisfied. So it'd be good to start here. How would you define or explain the narrative you are trying to have the reader take away with?
Sure. Well, I'm so glad that you really liked the book. That means a lot. It was a busy year. It came out in February 2020 amid a lot of other news. The Scientist and the Spy is at its core a very simple story. It starts with a man named Mo Hailong, or Robert Mo, who was found in a cornfield outside Des Moines. And it was a Monsanto cornfield. And the corn growing there was protected as a trade secret. And so his appearance there set off this 2-year FBI investigation involving car chases, airplanes flying overhead as surveillance planes, the use of a FISA warrant at one point. And so it's at its core about this one investigation. And I wanted to get into why the potential theft of corn had set off this massive response, and also some of the underlying technological tensions between the US and China. But it's also about these broader issues. Over the past 10 years, there have been dozens of investigations involving often ethnic Chinese scientists in the United States. This is something that started under the Obama administration, but that really accelerated under the Trump administration. And so it's a much broader issue, but I wanted to tell it through this very kind of colorful and at times comical story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to put some meat on the bones for readers who aren't deep into Monsanto and Iowa agriculture policy, why is a plant seed, or in that form, why is that a secret? And then why is that something that the US government is getting involved with when it comes to the broader conversation about the US and China?
Well, to make hybrid seeds, most of which are now genetically modified, it takes 5 to 8 years of intensive research. So companies like Monsanto, but also smaller seed companies, spend lots of money and lots of time developing these seeds. I'm not going to bore everyone with the whole process, but you need two parents. You need to develop each of those parents. Then you need to breed them out over several generations. And so this is something that companies spend a lot of money on. Now, where there's been a shift is that typically companies in the US would, if they suspected that someone had stolen their trade secrets, they would go to court. And it would be a civil case. They would sue the other company. But in the past few decades, the act of a foreign country or a company that is tied to a foreign government, sometimes even just in a foreign country, stealing a trade secret has been heavily criminalized. And so now these cases are being brought by the US government, and the FBI is devoting massive resources to investigating them. And then the US government is also devoting quite a lot of resources to prosecuting them.
It really is just such an amazing story. And the way you tell it, I mean, it's just narratively is perfect, because it's like it starts with this guy getting stopped by, what was it, like an Iowa State trooper or something, like, right? Or some highway patrol.
Sheriff's deputy.
And he's like, what are these guys doing out here? This just seems weird. Happens to write down the name and it all connects and it goes in this big thing. But that's kind of why I loved it, because it was like the human representation of something that we've talked a lot here about the podcast, and actually really in the last several years about industrial espionage, the US peer competition with China. It was cool to actually see it in practice and on a broader level, because I mean, like, Xi Jinping was involved at one point in your story. I was like, what? It's like cameos of everybody. So let's actually just get to, I guess, the bones of what we talk about a lot here, which is that, look, U.S. peer competition with China is going to be literally the defining story of the Trump era that will live on, you know, if anything, outside of the nonsense, and at least 4 years, 10 years, whatever, in the minimum. Do you think we're in a cold war with China right now?
It's certainly starting to look that way. Yes. I mean, it will be interesting to see what happens under the Biden administration, but I think certain issues are not going away. And as I show in the book, these tensions first showed up decades ago, but they really started to escalate under the Obama administration. And, some of the same officials who were in charge of this effort to prosecuting economic espionage cases under the Obama administration are now in the Biden administration. So I think it's not going away. What is new in the past few years is there's been a lot of pushback from Chinese American groups and scientists who feel like they're being targeted unfairly. And they're really pushing to have a dialogue with DOJ there's a sense that there's an overreaction to this issue. And, you know, I started, my background is that I was a reporter in China for many years. I was primarily a science reporter and I worked for the journal Science. And so when I started reporting this book, I was fairly agnostic and what I was going to find, but, you know, I was just kind of curious about what was going on with these, so many cases involving Chinese scientists and, you know, the fact that my beat was like suddenly, international news.
You know,
yeah, it felt like a very niche beat before that. And so I don't think we're going to go back to this era where, people could just kind of freely cross borders and have scientific cooperation, without more scrutiny on what that means. But these issues are very complicated because unlike in the Cold War of the, 60s, we are now so intertwined with China and, you know, our universities are intertwined, our people are intertwined. Our companies are very deeply invested in some ways. And, you know, one issue like Monsanto, for example, before they got interested in the issue of industrial espionage, they were trying very hard to get into the Chinese market. And, you know, for we have the situation where in China, you know, companies are somewhat independent, but they are ultimately beholden to the Chinese government.
Right.
And in the United States, I mean, there, we have a lot of issues with corporate donations and corporate influence, but at the end of the day, U.S. companies are not beholden to the U.S. government and they're beholden to their shareholders. And often their interests are in, I mean, it's just a cliche, but it's very true that their interests are sometimes in conflict with the interests of the country or with or human rights interests. And, you know, in China for many years, companies went in trying to make money, hoping to get just a piece of the pie. And then when it turned out that they weren't going to get that, that they were being kept out of the market, you saw the sudden shift to big corporations really hammering on this issue of industrial espionage and saying, you know, now we're being, now suddenly we care about this issue. And there is a certain hypocrisy in that.
Mm-hmm. So the immediate question, actually a million different questions come to mind. The first of which is, what would you say the lesson, if we can stipulate that there's a possibility that we could be in the midst of a second Cold War, what are the lessons from the first Cold War as relate to the topic of this issue? Because I think everyone listening to this podcast, we can all agree that no one wants Joseph McCarthy 2.0. No one wants the HUAC House. I'm HUAC. Not even bothered.
Yeah,
there we go. Thank you. No one, actually, I don't want to say no one, but we on this call don't want that. But at the same time, there actually was a serious Soviet espionage threat. So how do we balance those two things? Because the one thing I would also add to your point about how this is different from the U.S.-Soviet relationship is that there is a racial component to this. Kieran Skinner, a Trump administration official who was at the in charge of policy planning at the State Department, made a very controversial statement that I think was terribly phrased, a little historic and inaccurate, which was, this is the first time the U.S. has faced a rival power if it is not Caucasian. Now, that isn't true, like insert Japan. Mm-hmm. But the broad point, though, I think from a messaging perspective is true, which is that there's a dynamic here. You could have issues of Soviet spies and it wouldn't racialize or lead to the same potential discrimination that you could see today. So I'd just love to see your broader takeaway on what do we learn from the Soviet era?
Well, even going back to that era, there were, you know, conflict with China was obviously a big issue as well. And Chinese scientists faced a lot of scrutiny in that day as well. You know, the difference is that many of the researchers who were then living in the U.S. had actually fled China before 1949. And, you know, had ties to the Kuomintang and right. really had no plans to go back to China.
So just to be clear for people who don't know, Kuomintang was not, it was like the nationalist Chinese government.
Right. Not the communist. Socialist. Yeah.
Right.
But you know, then as now, they were targeted by the Chinese government. The US was aware that there was this desire in China to really build up its technological talent, in part by recruiting people back to China. And so the response was really the wrong way of dealing with it, which is just to blanket surveil almost everybody of Chinese descent who was doing research in the United States. And so this is something I tell this story of the kind of wacky seed case that involves airport busts and like smuggling of corn seed back to China and microwave popcorn bags and, you know, all of these strange elements. And then I wove in some of these examples from history. One thing I found by doing FOIA requests was that there was a dedicated program to surveil ethnic Chinese scientists in the United States in the 60s and 70s. And not just people who had close ties to the mainland, but like people who were ethnic Chinese from Malaysia or, you know, were several generations mm-hmm. out from China. And the legacy of that is that there is a lot of mistrust within the Chinese American community. There have been cases even more recently that were botched or mishandled. The Wen Holi case back in the late 1990s was an espionage case of a researcher at Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory, but that was also botched. And so, you know, there's a lot of mistrust there. And at the same time, the research force in the United States, a lot of it is foreign-born. And, you know, if the goal is really protecting innovation in America, then we have to figure out a way to deal with these technological tensions without seriously alienating people.
Yeah, it's such a difficult question because it's like you said, there's botched cases. I just remember this case, so I just brought it up. But like 2 weeks ago, an MIT professor, his name is Gang Chen, I mean, he was just facing federal charges, right? For his hiding these payments he's taking from the Chinese Communist Party while working at MIT. Same thing. And I think we saw similar cases at Harvard and elsewhere. And it's like you said, our university system is so deeply intertwined, not just on the research level, but also in terms of the amount of money that comes in from foreign students. Like the economic intertwinement is a really key part of the story here, which is why it's just so complicated to try and disentangle this. I guess, you know, one of the interesting things, I think I heard you say this in a different interview you gave, which is that prosecuting, you know, people for industrial espionage and more, it's kind of like the war on drugs. Like you can go after people, but that's not necessarily going to solve it. What does solving it look like? Because, you know, at the end of the day, this is about pure competition. And so, like, what do you say, like, the core root or the issue is? I mean, I think it's much more, you know, high level, which is that, you know, in many ways, the previous iteration of Chinese espionage and peer competition with the U.S. was definitely based on just like straight up ripping and copying demand or copying products. But it hasn't been that way now for quite some time. Like, they're very capable of creating, launching and doing many of their own things, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the show. Just like how do you think about that dynamic there?
Well, the case of Gang Chen is the MIT mm-hmm. scientist, he's actually a department chair, is really an interesting one. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out because the initial press release that DOJ or that prosecutors in Boston issued accused him of hiding this crazy amount of money. And it was like $19 million mm-hmm. and, you know, was filled with pretty serious allegations. And then when the indictment came out, it turned out that the charges were more minor. And the situation there is that MIT has had this collaboration with this university in China. And that $19 million were...
It's like part of the research grant or something? Okay.
MIT had this collaboration with a university in China. Gong Chen was the lead scientist on it. And so, you know, whether MIT should have had that collaboration is an interesting question that we need to ask. But what happens often is that there are these questionable relationships that develop. And then instead of dealing with the entity, or in this case, a university that's involved, you throw the individual under the bus. Mm-hmm. That happened in other cases that I looked at for my book. And so, you know, we have this deeper problem that needs to be addressed probably through bigger policy changes. And just dealing with these low-level individuals is a little bit like arresting people off the street corner.
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting when you're saying that is I actually completely agree with you. I didn't know the full, you know, thing on the case, but you're right, which is that, okay, if that's the case, then like MIT needs to face some serious problems here. Same with Harvard. One of the things that Yeah.
Well, and I don't even know if there was technology transferred in that case. It was a nanotech case. It's sensitive technology. So it's definitely worth asking those questions. Right. What I do know is that the charges against Gong Chen, as when they came out, were involving lying to the FBI, which, you know, it's fairly easy to get somebody on that charge, and hiding money from a foreign bank account, as I recall. So,
right. You know, I was just thinking it in the context of what you said about Monsanto, which is that, yeah, they were desperately trying to enter the Chinese market. Like, they would have done anything, I bet, in order to go in there. It was the CCP who was like, no, you're not coming in here. You're not going to run our agricultural sector. And this is actually something that they've done with a whole host of companies. And as you said, a lot of corporations were desperate to get into China. Only whenever they found out that they weren't going to be able to go, then they were like, okay, now, like, the government has to come and protect us. Facebook. So something Marshall and
Facebook
I talk, yeah, Facebook is yeah. like the peak example. Something Marshall and I talk a lot about here, though, is incentives. So I'm actually curious, you know, if you were going to look at it from like a drug war incentive or, you know, and other more, wouldn't it just be easier to just rule it out for them to say, no, like, you guys aren't going to do business in China? This is something I've been thinking about for a long time. Like, if you remove that as their ability, let's say, especially in like strategic sectors, if we were to designate like tech, you know, food is definitely one of them and maybe a few others. I'm not proposing a total U.S. ban on business with China, maybe in different sectors. That would just change the dynamic there, because it's like you said, there does seem to be some hypocrisy at a base level.
Yeah, you know, so there's a shift. The EU has been looking at designating surveillance technologies, you know, including facial recognition and so forth, as export control eligible. Mm-hmm. And in the US, I think we have fairly narrow use of export controls right now, but certain instances that have come up in China have certainly challenged that. And, you know, looking at like companies that have been working in Xinjiang, for example, companies, genetics companies, the tech companies. And, you know, I don't think these issues will continue to come up. And yeah, it's much more complicated than just Chinese companies are trying to insert their surveillance technology around the world, right? It's these corporate interests in all countries that are really, you know, see China as this great market for their products.
Yeah, and I think that's why, though, Sagar, to push back against my co-host, but I don't think banning is actually the simpler answer, because in most of these cases, it's unclear what banning would actually mean. But also on a deeper level, the problem here is that this is so industry specific and sector by sector, but at a certain point, it seems like the broader complaint is that you have a system where people need to make money and expand it in markets. So at an underlying level, I'm not quite sure what legislation underlyingly changes that. But a broader question I want to ask you is, help us understand the state of the FBI from your perspective, because what I think is so interesting here is the narrative of what the FBI is and how it's perceived just perpetually shifting. So in the 1960s, it's a bunch of goons, like actual, like straight, like actual, goons. Like racist goons, like led by J. Edgar Hoover. They're tapping the Kennedys, they're tapping MLK, all sorts of excess during the Vietnam War era, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have the 1990s stuff. Then during the Trump era, interestingly enough, the pendulum swings a little bit. So then the FBI, I think because of James Comey and Trumpian politics, becomes a real cause of the center left. So now like books about the FBI really sell well there. So just help us understand where is the narrative right now? Like, how should we understand the FBI? Because operationally, it's not partisan, but it's very clear that both sides of the aisles, not to be whataboutist, but both sides of the aisle will reinterpret the FBI, its function, and whether it's good or bad, based upon their own narratives. And the one thing I'll add to this, too, is that post-Capitol insurrection, the FBI is now deeply engaged in the follow-up and, you know, plans to surveil and engage people who are involved. And once again, I have no problem with that. But once again, like, that's another clear indication of how these pendulums shift. So just help us understand the narrative of the FBI.
Yeah, it's true. We are in this very strange period, and we have been for much of the Trump administration, where people on the left feel all warm and fuzzy about the FBI. It's something I dealt with in the process of reporting my book. But you know, look, I'm a reporter with The Intercept. We cover surveillance and we cover the intelligence community from this very critical perspective, and I spent a lot of time with intelligence agents for this book, particularly the lead FBI agent who worked on the case. He, you know, was very giving of his time, which I really appreciated. But, you know, ultimately it's not that the FBI was bad in the 1960s and is great today. There are certain systemic issues that have been around for decades that have, you know, improved somewhat, but that are still issues. One of them is diversity within the Bureau, is particularly on these cases involving Chinese American scientists is an issue. You know, it's also probably one of the reasons that so much of the intelligence involving the Capitol insurrection was overlooked. But, you know, I talked to Asian American agents who felt like they were really sidelined, and that they were, one guy told me that in some cases at one point his supervisor told him not to date other Asian American women because, you know, they could be trying to get information from him. And he was like, well, are you saying I just have to date white girls? So, I mean, this was a fairly recent conversation that gets at where some of the biases might be in these cases. But I think, you know, whether the FBI is going after Capitol insurrectionists or going after people who targeted trade secrets of US multinationals, or going after, you know, so-called Black identity extremists, the issues are the same, right? You know, we should not be using certain surveillance technologies when they're not justified. We shouldn't be using Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants when it's not an issue of extreme national security, you know, it's not like an immediate terror threat. And I think also if you look back to the post 9/11 reaction, you had a legitimate threat that then provoked an overreaction, in some cases a wrong reaction, you know, attention to the wrong areas. I can see parallels with what's happened with economic espionage and trade secrets theft from China. We have a legitimate threat, it's a legitimate issue, but you know, you have to deal with it in a way that isn't counterproductive.
So this is the part where I need to be an audience advocate and ask the question, which is almost certainly on most people's minds, which is like, okay, what about Christine Fang, who was the, and please correct me if I'm like mischaracterizing this, but she was effectively a Chinese spy who pursued relationships with up and coming politicians in the United States and like very clearly was part of that effort. So for example, as I'm thinking, and I'm correct me if I'm wrong, as you're bringing up the example of the Asian American agent who was told not to date Asian women, was the point there based? Was the FBI's logic that, you know, any Asian women who are trying to date you are probably going to be Chinese spies? So it's basically just easier for you just to date white women. So how do I'm just trying to think, like, how do you balance this? Because what I definitely think is going to happen, you have, you know, in the state of California, I'm pretty sure it was Barbara Boxer's driver who was, you know, Chinese American. Dianne Feinstein. Driver was a Chinese spy. So what I feel is certainly going to happen, this is why you're right to highlight issues of discrimination, is I guarantee you the next time there is an Asian American woman in California politics who is maybe a little socially awkward or asks too many questions, people are going to say, hey, is this Christine Fang 2.0? So how should people just think about this? Because we're stuck between, because let me take one more step back. What makes this so hard is that this isn't 1950s, jump under your desks because the nuclear bombs are going to fall. There actually is a genuine issue where things genuinely happen. And there have been politicians and institutions, education or governmental or otherwise, who have screwed up their security here. So how should we all just broadly think of this as people who are good faith and don't want to discriminate, but also don't want to be incredibly stupid as certain politicians were?
Well, first of all, I would separate straight up espionage with political spying of the sort that you're talking about from industrial espionage. They're sometimes lumped into the same category, but I think that stealing seeds from Monsanto is a different sort of issue. Yeah. And, you know, even the US government has tried to distinguish them and carve out this norm, which is disputed by some, that it is spying for political secrets is something that all nations do, whereas spying for industrial secrets is something that the US doesn't do. That's disputed, but you know, even the US government makes that distinction. So, but then when you look actually at recent Chinese espionage cases, and I've written about a number of them, they're pretty diverse. So a number of, you know, some have involved Chinese Americans or Chinese nationals, as you mentioned, but there was also the case of Glenn Shriver, who was a recent college graduate in China. Who, I mean, this is like the details of this are so kind of cheesy and cinematic, and the FBI did actually make a very cheesy film about it. He was in Shanghai and he responded to an essay contest asking for an essay on the future of US-China relations, and was recruited by Chinese intelligence that way. And then they tried to groom him to apply to the CIA. He applied multiple times, I believe, and then he was caught. But there are several cases like that where it's the person who is not typically suspected, you know, in this case, a young white guy who ends up being the target of Chinese intelligence. And I think one of the issues is that there has been an kind of fundamental misunderstanding and even underestimation of the capacity of Chinese intelligence services. They're not a monolith. There are several different intelligence agencies like there are here, and they're very sophisticated. I mean, they rolled up the CIA's network in China and shot some people in broad daylight a few years ago. So, you know, I think there are multiple tactics that are being tried and many different types of people who are being targeted. So looking specifically at one type of person is really not productive in that case. That is a trope. That's an idea that goes back decades within the intelligence agencies. I talked about this in the book, that there was even a kind of name for this theory that justified profiling people, but the evidence just doesn't really bear it out at this point.
That's an excellent point. It's funny. I was thinking about that story the other day about, remember, like right when Trump was elected, there were all these stories about how good the KGB was and all this. And then, I mean, the Chinese are the ones who basically destroyed the entire like CIA network within a single month, which was, I mean, from an intelligence perspective, was actually like crazy impressive. And I remember reading a little bit about how it all went down, and I was like, that's insane. I want to pick up on something that you were talking about there, which is industrial espionage being different than state, I guess, spycraft in the think of political espionage. And I'm not sure I even agree. Well, I think I agree with it from a U.S. perspective, because what you pointed out there was that earlier in the show about how, you know, American companies fundamentally do not act at the behest of the U.S. state. Whereas like Chinese companies do. Like what was that company called in the book, DBN, right? Is that what it is?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so DBN, right?
DBN is the Chinese agricultural company.
Is the Chinese agriculture, which tried to steal the seeds. I mean, like DBN is being tasked with something which would be beneficial to CCP and the main, you know, 2025 plan, like all of that, like all like fits together. And so from that perspective, I kind of think industrial espionage, when the Chinese do it, or is like kind of a tool of their statecraft, because it's very much a part of their state capitalist strategy in order to dominate in key sectors, which are geostrategic for them. Like they think about the arms of their companies and others as tools of their state. I'm not saying the U.S. doesn't do it either, but there's a reason I think that we refer to our stuff as soft power when I don't think that they really have that concept over there. So, or maybe I'm wrong. Like, tell me whether
you know,
I am.
DBN, the agricultural company that Robert Mueller worked for, and the company that sent him and others to the U.S. to try to steal seeds, with the goal of bringing them back to China to reverse engineer them. I don't think it was so much that DBN was tasked by the Chinese government. I think in a lot of cases, it's that there are these incentives to make technological breakthroughs, and companies know that the government's going to look the other way. And so, you know, I think with some more strategic technology, you know, with some dual use technologies that get closer to military work, that it is a more direct tasking. But in this case, you know, Robert Mueller, as far as I can tell, did not have any contact with intelligence agencies. Right. And he was this kind of hapless.
But like he was a delegate, right? He was a delegate to that. I remember reading that he faked his way or whatever as a delegate when Xi Jinping visited Iowa. So I'm like, well, I mean, like, what are we supposed to think?
Yeah. So he... That's an interesting scene in the book. There, so Xi Jinping at that point was next in line to be leader, but was not yet. Had organized this trip to Iowa with this big agricultural delegation. And, you know, the governor, Terry Branstad, who later became the ambassador to China, is there. All the big egg companies are there. And Robert Mueller takes the name tag of somebody else on the delegation and sneaks into the event. And I don't really know, you know, I talked quite a bit to the FBI agent who investigated this, as well as to prosecutors. And I actually think that he was just there trying to like make connections. This other woman who figured in the case was there as well. And no one could really figure out. The FBI tailed him from the minute that he flew in for that particular meeting, but no one really figured out like what he was up to on that particular trip. You know, there were other scenes in the book that were much clearer. And one of the reasons I chose this case was because the FBI had bugged Robert and his colleagues' cars for 2 years. And so I had whole chunks of dialogue of like what they were saying to each other in the car. And I thought this is just really a wonderful opportunity to tell a case like scene by scene in detail. Yeah. Because I think so often we don't get that level of insight into what happened.
So as we're nearing the end here, we're talking about the U.S. government, how it acts, and how the Chinese government acts. And you had a quote in a different episode, which I thought was incredibly helpful for understanding this, which is, in times of tension, Cold War historians believe there's this mirroring that goes on. We start to behave like the enemy, and that's the big risk. And I feel like that is the moment we're in now. So I'd love for you to expand a little bit on that idea, but I just want to get to the concept of, is it possible there's such thing as good mirroring? So copying your enemy or rival, because that could be a good thing, but there could also be bad mirroring. So for example, it's entirely possible that during the 1930s, and I'm not trying to literally draw an exact, this is like Hitler all over again. It's a little more complicated than that, obviously, but during the 1930s, an enemy slash rival was Nazi Germany. And the thing that enemy and rival was doing was rearming incredibly aggressively. So from my perspective, actually, and during that time of tension, the proper response was to copy what the enemy was doing. It wasn't to say, hey, like, let's invade other countries and take the Sudetenland for ourselves. But it was to say, hey, we should also be increasing our investment in new in planes, tanks, the Navy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how do we distinguish between the idea that sometimes playing in the game of international politics requires responding to moves, but then how do we recognize that there is the idea of we could just go too far the other direction? So it'd be helpful to understand mm-hmm. that dichotomy there.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel. It reminds me a little bit of the Zuckerberg argument that if you regulate US mm-hmm. tech, China will win, which of course he arrived at that argument after years of, you know, displaying Xi Jinping's book on his desk and going for runs in Tiananmen Square, which like nobody runs in Tiananmen Square. It's slippery yeah. and he would fall.
When I was there, it was really cold.
Yeah. It's not, yeah. it's nowhere to jog. Yeah. So, you know, unlike in the 30s, there is, Let me think how to rephrase this.
Let me operationalize yeah. a little bit to make this a little more specific, because my point here is one could, for example, read or listen to that quote and conclude that what you're saying is, well, when China bans, and maybe you oppose this, but when China says American companies cannot come into China, especially in the digital software space. So for example, China just banned Clubhouse from Clubhouse, the audio app, from actually occurring there. Any claim that the US should reciprocate or should also say, well, if American companies can't compete in China fairly, then Chinese companies can't compete fairly here. From my perspective, and there's a nuanced debate we could have about that on a different episode, but my point is someone could read your quote and just sum up the position that there needs to be dual capacity. So if China gets in, we could get in, vice versa. Someone could say that making that demand is just me saying we should just copy China and mirror, and that's bad. So I'm just trying to get to how do we, because I love how you brought up the Mark Zuckerberg argument, because in many ways it's sort of bad faith, it's political PR. I'm just trying to get to like, no, but seriously, like, how do we think about this? Because yeah, it would be totally wrong to say, hey, like, China supports its company, so now we need to, like, you know, have the state take over everything.
Yeah, and we should own everything.
Yeah, it's like, no. The response isn't to say, like, you know what, Mark Cuban took down the national anthem, nationalize the NBA and make him do X, Y, and Z. That's not the point here. So how should we think about this?
No, there have been calls for reciprocity, as it's called with China for years, in everything from visas to journalists. You know, as a journalist myself, I had the experience of waiting over a year for a visa, and that, you know, I had colleagues who had much worse experiences. And of course, people who were then kicked out last year. Mm-hmm. And that's something the US finally took up under the Trump administration. But there have also been calls for reciprocity in the area of industrial espionage and in kind of targeted sanctions. And the Trump administration did try some of those strategies, and actually think some of them were a good idea. But, you know, the problem is that it came with all the other noise of the Trump administration. So like a trade war that is started ostensibly because of industrial espionage. And then like, now we're closing the Houston consulate because of industrial espionage. And just this intense flare up of racism as well. And it was, you know, all of that, I think that those comments that you mentioned, I said that amid all of the craziness of last spring, when the China had just kicked out a lot of journalists. The US was retaliating by kicking out Chinese journalists. There was this tit for tat. Meanwhile, the pandemic was escalating. And there is a real risk of things spiraling out of control.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. It's like what Marshall said. I mean, I'm definitely a reciprocity caller. I'll own up to it. I have been public about it for a while. And I mean, with the Clubhouse thing, it just seems so, as I understand it, the day Clubhouse was banned was because the night before there was a room about Xinjiang and on the concentration camps there.
There were quite a lot of rooms over the weekend. I think I was, I was the only China journalist who didn't spend my whole weekend on Clubhouse.
Well, you know, I actually had the privilege yesterday when this was all going down. I was on Clubhouse and I actually got to talk to Ai Weiwei. And I asked him, I said, Ai Weiwei, for people who don't know, he's a Nobel Prize winner. He was an artist in China, a dissident who was imprisoned. I think he lives somewhere in Europe now. But I asked him, I said, Ai Weiwei, what do you think the only way to change Chinese behavior is? And he said, you could talk, I'm paraphrasing. He's like, you could talk about human rights and that all day long, all they understand is profit. All you can do is target profit. And so when I think about reciprocity, like in this context, like Clubhouse, an American company, just got valued at $1 billion, got like 6 million users. I think it's going to take off. I mean, it's banned in its infancy almost immediately in China because of not just Xinjiang. I'm sure they also look at it from a tech perspective. And then I look at, you know, our market. We have TikTok, which is a ByteDance controlled company, which is, you know, exists and operates in China, where 1/4 of American citizens are. And I just say, I don't think that's right. I mean, I do not think it is right that this company, which has and easily could be, you know, there's no such thing as a subpoena. Like if they were like, give us your records, they're like, okay, they literally have to, or they can't exist. And their CEO, Zhang Zemin, I mean, he has already done activities at the behest of the Chinese Communist Party that we allow, you know, from a fairness perspective, this app, which look, this isn't a judgment on the app. I'm saying like, you know, like this is a Chinese controlled app, which is a penetrated high levels in our marketplace. And we don't even get the chance to try and do the opposite over there.
I agree with you on TikTok. So this is something I've reported on myself. Mm-hmm. And there's also, you know, there's a lot of evidence that they have censored. They've censored posts related to the camps in Xinjiang. They've since censored posts by so-called like ugly people. I mean, it's a problematic app, but at the same time, the solution is not to give it to a US tech company. Maybe that's part of the solution, but we have to have a much more holistic approach. And so like one of the issues you see in my book with the Monsanto case is that the entire case was brought ostensibly to protect innovation in the United States. But the seed industry is a highly concentrated industry that's controlled by just a few companies.
Right.
And even in the course of my reporting, Monsanto was acquired by Bayer. So by the end of the case, it was no longer even an American company. So you have this irony of the US government expending massive resources trying to protect the IP of an American company, and the company just leaves its borders. So when you look at the issue of Chinese technology companies and the concern that they could pass on data to the Chinese government, I think we also have to look at how the industry is developing other places, because there's massive problems with the tech industry here. And, you know, if we leave it completely unregulated, we're not going to be much better off.
And this is why I'm glad that we're framing this conversation, at least on the China side, as being about reciprocity, because there's entirely a conversation to be had about U.S. data privacy and American companies. But I get very frustrated there's an entirely legitimate case to be made against the way the Trump administration handled the TikTok ban. But the question of Facebook and Google's data is entirely different than the question of reciprocity when it comes to American and Chinese tech companies. So to a certain degree, it frustrates me when those issues are conflated. I think it's possible to argue that we have a reciprocity issue with China, and also say that on the domestic side, we have American technology companies that need to be regulated in different ways as well too. So that's important. So to take us out, I just want to ask this. It's been basically a year almost since the book came out. The paperback is out now. As you referenced at the start, it's not great to drop a book right before the coronavirus. I'm sure the book may have turned, you know, turned out slightly differently in certain respects. What has changed in the past year, or has advanced the narratives or ideas you were interested in?
Yeah, to go back to your point that you just made, I agree with you that the two are conflated, the issue of Chinese tech companies being too closely connected to the Chinese government, and then also the issue of reciprocity. But the issues that with industrial espionage, they are often conflated by companies in the industry, in like the seed industry, for example. So what's changed in the past year? Well, a lot.
One is over Zoom.
Yeah. Literally everything.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, one is that people stormed the Capitol in part because they thought that China had submarines off our shores. And
was that part of
that? That was one oh, okay. post right. that I saw. There were so many variations yeah. on
I
the
can't
theme
keep up.
Of
JFK Jr.'s alive, you know. It's
a whole new world. There is so yeah. many different variations on the theme of like,
yeah.
China did all of this and we need to stop them from stealing the election. So that was not an issue at the moment that my book came out, but the general discussion around industrial espionage has intensified. You know, the US closed the Houston consulate in yeah. July and gave the issue of industrial espionage as a reason for doing that. You know, also just in general, it's not just the Trump administration and concerns about the pandemic that have escalated US-China tensions. I mean, China's also encroached severely on Hong Kong. There's been a lot of advocacy and activism around the camps in Xinjiang, and a lot more has come out on what is actually happening there in the past year. So that's becoming a more urgent issue. And, you know, the Chinese government in general has used the cover of the pandemic to tighten control. So, you know, once normal business resumes, it will be very interesting to see how industrial espionage kind of plays into this mix.
My last question on industrial espionage is really more of just what do we know about Chinese espionage on the vaccine process? Because
and not just China, every country on earth is trying to figure this out. That must be the ground zero for everything we're talking about.
I think that the timeline was Russia, then China, and then Pfizer, right? I believe. Mm-hmm. That's what it actually was. But yeah, that must have been maybe one of the biggest industrial espionage efforts in modern memory. What do we know generally about it? Not just China, but I'm sure Russia was involved. I'm sure, you know, Iran, like whomever.
Sure, we're doing something to
and you know, so that gets to the central issue. I mean, I really believe that the vaccine rollout should not be controlled by a few big corporations or, you know, nationalized in the case of China. It's problematic that people, mm-hmm. to me, that people in the US or for example, Israel are getting the vaccine before people in the developing world. You know, I'm in Europe right now and the government where I am was very slow to get the vaccine. And so like, it's really not being rolled out as quickly. And I just find that entire process mind-boggling, but definitely each side is trying to figure out what the other is doing.
Yeah. Well, it's been a fascinating episode, Mara. Thank you so much for joining us. Marshall and I literally loved the book. I didn't even know you, and I, you know, put it on my best books of the year and all that. So we were really glad that you could stop by, release of the paperback. We've got it up on our bookshop. Highly recommend that everybody go and buy it there. Support Mara, and you support the show. So thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. It's been great.
Thanks for coming. Hope you all enjoyed the episode. As always, be sure to share this with your friends. Check out our bookshop.org link, where we would love you to check out the paperback edition of Mara's book and send us a question. We always really appreciate it. Last but not least, huge thank you to the Lincoln Network. We will see you all next Tuesday.